On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Atrolado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Atrolado in the description of this episode or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elatrolado.org/volunteer. El Atrolado, ALOTROLADO.org/volunteer. White supremacy means a political and economic system that privileges white people and locates all or almost all power in their hands. When I say America is a white supremacist nation, I don't mean all white people have Klan hoods in their closet. Far from it. I mean the country is run by a system that rewards whiteness and punishes other races. White supremacy means the way white people have the overwhelming majority of wealth and political power in this country. It's the way white people are more likely to get hired and less likely to be killed by the police. America might be the greatest country on earth, but it will never be as great as it could be until we dismantle white supremacy. How do we do that? How do we fight against white supremacy? My friend, the writer Akiba Solomon, and her friend, Kenria Rankin, have put together a fascinating anthology called How We Fight White Supremacy that has a lot of ideas about the way forward. Let's get into it. It's Akiba Solomon and Kenria Rankin, the authors of How We Fight White Supremacy, on Touré Show.
I'm Akiba Solomon.
Hi, I'm Kenria Rankin.
What is white supremacy?
So we define white supremacy in the book as a cultural, economic, and political system that thrives on the subjugation of people who are not white.
Yeah. Where do we see it?
Everywhere.
True. Like, help me. Give me an example of it so we can help people. Because I think people know what interpersonal racism is, and they generally default to that when we talk about
racism. It makes it easy
racism.
To say I'm not a racist.
Yeah, but even black people, I think, quite often see, like, somebody said something where they're really talking about microaggressions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of people know about white supremacy, but they don't know necessarily, like, where do you see it?
I mean, you can see it in housing regulations. You can see it in dog whistle politics. You
who's
can see
hired, who's not hired.
Who's hired, who gets paid the most, who doesn't. You know, who it's okay to discriminate against mm-hmm. and is socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
We see it at the White House.
Of course.
We see it in foreign policy.
Education.
I mean, so we posit that this is sort of like a cancer or a smog. And it's global, so we focus yep. on the states in the book because we couldn't do the whole world.
We can't contain all of our brilliance.
Yes,
of the world
but that's
in
a good way
volume.
To put it. Yeah, we couldn't contain our brilliance. but you know, it's, I mean, it in some ways it's all encompassing. Like it definitely shapes how people's lives end up.
Right. And we breathe it in like smog, even when we don't realize we are.
Yeah, you reference like. PTSD that we all have coming from it. Is it, where does that function? Is it like, you know, I watch Alton Sterling and I am traumatized. I read about Emmett Till, you know, I see Sandra Bland, I'm traumatized, you know, like then the microaggression I had to deal with when I was going into work. And
yes.
by that point, just, you know, I'm filled up. Is that like...
It mounts and it's exhausting, right? When you are constantly having to deal with somebody trying to touch your hair or watching somebody who looks just like you being killed by police or hearing the police describe a little boy who looks like you as a thug and taking away his humanity. All of that mounts and you're walking around in that all day and it is... exhausting and it is traumatic and violent.
I wonder how what it does to all of us, the gigantic number of snuff films that we have
that's
in our
exactly
head from the
are.
Past, what, 4 or 5 years? That's huge. I mean, I could call up 10 in my short-term memory without a problem. You probably the same.
Yeah.
Just, like all of us, like what is that doing to us?
I mean, I think there are studies that show that if you watch a lot of violent events, that you become desensitized to them. And also that, you know, you because you have a greater appetite, then the violence grows. But I do think that there's a big difference between knowing that you're going to watch a film, paying to watch a film, sitting down, choosing entertainment, and being blindsided by video just out of nowhere of somebody being shot in the head by police.
Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of therapists in the book, and one of them specifically talks about race-based trauma and how folks, black folks living, you know, we, again, narrow our focus to America, but how when we are in these spaces that are white and not made for us and are violent, that we can have actual signs of PTSD, the same symptoms.
Okay, the book is... How do we fight white supremacy?
How we fight white supremacy.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So how do we fight white supremacy?
Well, I mean, we did the book in 10 chapters, and they're based on conventional black wit and wisdom. And basically what we wanted to do is talk about our cultural interventions. We wanted to talk about grassroots work. But we also wanted to talk about kids as activists. We wanted to talk about spirituality. We have a chapter about love.
Yep.
We have a chapter, our last chapter is about freedom dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this idea that, you know, if you don't take a pause and actually envision what freedom looks like, then we're going to have trouble getting there. And so, you know, we also have a chapter, it's called Laugh to Keep from Crying, where we just have like satire from Kiese Layman and, you know, comedic essays from Damon Young and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the gist of the book is that we fight white supremacy on a million different frequencies and that we're not a monolith and that you could be fighting white supremacy without thinking consciously, you know, hi, good morning, I'm fighting white supremacy.
The reality is on some days just getting out of bed is fighting it. Like on the day after the election. Getting out of bed was fighting. That was resisting.
That was resistance.
Yeah.
Just because I've been watching Homecoming and talking about if you can't see it, you can't be it.
That's right.
So let's start at the end where you talk about, you know, Alicia Garza's piece about what it looks like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what does freedom from white supremacy actually look like? And then we can go back about the road to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it really depends on the person, and that's why we have so many different folks weighing in that last chapter. The hope is that, you know, by the time people finish the book, they are able to do two things. One, they're able to really think about what a future without white supremacy looks like, what it feels like, what it tastes like, what it sounds like. And then the other is that they are now able to complete a sentence that we asked people to complete throughout the book, which was, "I fight white supremacy by ... That they're able to either really look at the ways that they're already fighting, because of what we encountered with a lot of people was that when we asked them that question, they really had to sit and reflect, and they realized, oh, shit, I am already fighting it. Mm. And so it made them then be more intentional about the way that they do those things. Mm-hmm. And then for some folks, it was just like, huh, I really need to sit with this and try to figure out the way that I will. And that's what we hope that people will do when they finish. In the book, we write, so there's 10 chapters, as Akiba was saying. And at the end of each chapter, we answer a question that relates to the theme. And we answer it via very, very personal essays. Mm-hmm. And so our ways of what that freedom looks like, the way that we describe it, comes out in our essays at the end. And so for me, that looks like being able to bring my whole self to every table.
Mm.
Not feeling like I have to leave a part of myself at the door, not having a code switch, which I have been freed from, not having to wonder why I'm at the table, not gaslighting my damn self and, you know, getting all into that imposter syndrome that so many of us carry around and wondering, why do I get to be here? Why do I deserve it? And I'm just me all the fucking time.
Amen to that. Wait, so where is this world where you get to be yourself?
That's when we get rid of white supremacy. But right now, I am intentionally doing a lot of those things.
What's wrong with code switching?
Nothing is wrong with code switching. It's just, for me, it's exhausting.
Okay.
I am so tired of...
But freedom is that we don't have to.
Yes.
Yeah,
that we exactly. live in a world where if I don't do that, that I don't have to worry that I'm not going to get a job. That I don't have to worry that someone is going to think that I'm not as smart as they are because I say ain't and fuck. You know what I mean? Like, I get to be me, and it's not negatively impacting me because anti-blackness is so pervasive that anything that is a marker of me being a black woman is a negative thing, and it's going to detrimentally impact me.
Because code switching is what we have to do to accommodate
That's
them.
Right.
They don't code switch to us.
Ever.
No, I mean, and I also think that there is a sort of performative code switching mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. do. You know,
which is obnoxious and
oh yeah, it's obnoxious and it's not a survival mechanism and
right.
it's actually a microaggression.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
but you know we are forced to code switch in so many different ways: body language, mm-hmm. the faces you make,
the hair, clear,
you know
the
how hair, you yes. speak,
the way you talk,
the yep. hair. Yep. You know, and I think it's important, like, to mention that we don't judge people who
Absolutely
code switch.
Not,
I mean, it's
we
definitely,
had to do it.
Yeah, we had to do it.
I mean, we all love Oprah. We all love Barack Obama.
I mean. And it's how we got to the point where we are, where we can decide not to do it. We had to do it for years and years and years.
Yes.
I was terrible at it. I was never very good at it.
Yeah, my face is expressive.
Mine too. Yeah.
It's interesting to even imagine a world without it because... I am good at it, and so much of my career has been being able to perform mm-hmm. it, and to think about not having to do it, it's sort of unimaginable.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's sort of crazy.
But think about how much energy it takes.
I mean, you know, it's second nature to me, mm-hmm. and I try to never be outside of myself to where, you know, if I stepped outside, I'd be like, I am embarrassed to have said that or done that.
Right, oh, right. Yeah.
And I've definitely been the person in an all-white space who was like, fuck that. That's bullshit.
Yeah, of course.
God, I remember we got into a big argument. It wasn't even an argument. It was a silent argument. It was like, you know, like...
It was a standoff.
So somebody in the space said... I'm trying to describe it without fully describing where it was,
right,
so that the people
right,
that would be offended.
Right, right. Yep.
The comment was that we had to do something about Black History Month, and the person said, "What about White History Month?"
Oh my
and
god!
And I said,
"That is so unoriginal."
Totally. And I said, "That's every month."
Hello. Mm-hmm.
But then, like, there was like a, it was like a silence bomb dropped.
Because
everyone just like turned around and like went back to their desk and was like, Torre said something obnoxious again. And I'm like, well, I spoke the truth
you
and
did.
You were shunning me. And it was,
they weren't ready.
It was
for
definitely
it.
Hurtful. And yeah, they weren't, they weren't ready for it.
Wow.
And we, you know, we deal with that sort of stuff in the office
all
the time.
All day, all night.
So you want paper, you go to work. Most of us work in spaces that are mostly white. So what do?
I mean, so in the Laugh to Keep from Crying essay that I write in the book, I talk about sarcasm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've learned to adapt my sense of humor to exist in those spaces. But also, like, if I get blindsided by a crazy comment, it used to really drive me crazy. You know, I used to curse people out, throw things, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I did.
yeah, it's a whole story.
It's a whole thing.
I can't throw things.
It's a whole thing.
Black man get arrested for throwing things.
It's amazing you did it.
Well, I mean, I was at the source. So was it?
Yeah, I mean, oh, the source is the Wild West.
Right. I mean, it was like, why didn't you, you know, throw a shoe? Like, so, but you know, like in terms of the survival mechanism of sarcasm, the survival mechanism of basically clowning somebody without coming out and saying it. Mm-hmm. So the person knows that in some way you've resisted or you've menaced them.
They feel unsettled and they don't quite know why.
Yeah. And you're just sort of like, you know, so one thing I also learned was a good hand on the shoulder. So if somebody was spinning out of control over a fact that they got wrong, that I was employed to check, then I would like gently pat somebody on the shoulder. And, you know, sometimes I was like, am I being a mammy or am I just trying to keep from shaking you? And I think it was keep from shaking you because you are like, you're so excited. And I'm just like, you need to calm down.
So are we talking in this about surviving or combating to the point of eventually dismantling white supremacy?
I think it runs the gamut in the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, that's a major part of what we wanted to do, to meet people where they are.
That's right.
And so, you know, we have professional activists, professional strategists, and then, you know, we have a witch in the book. Mm-hmm. Haylen Blay.
Yeah, her essay is fantastic.
So, you know, I mean, we have a woman, Mia Birdsong, who, you know, she lived out in the country and she learned how to grow her own food.
Wow.
For the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Like, she wants to have her own skill that she can bring to the revolution. And I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm. I think a huge part of the problem is the wealth gap. Mm-hmm. And truly combating white supremacy has got to involve wealth acquisition and all the everything that goes along with that. We need not just more black billionaires, but more black millionaires and fewer poor black people. And the political power that goes along with having money. Is that a big part of the prescriptive?
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to worm out of that question, but we don't look at this book as prescriptive.
Right.
Okay.
We look at it as generative. We look at it as both a celebration and an articulation. Mm-hmm. That said, definitely the wealth gap is a persistent problem, and it's one of those problems that fits quite squarely under white supremacy. So you have a wealth gap because it actually buttresses white supremacy, right, the same way transphobia does or ableism does or any of these other isms. We call them little helpers, mm-hmm, in that, you know, you can't vanquish white supremacy without dealing with the tentacles of it.
Right.
Exactly. And there's a chapter in the book called I Make Money Moves that looks at entrepreneurship and wealth generation as a strategy as well.
You know, I can hear some of the white people who are listening to this thinking, well, I mean, you know, I'm an ally, you know.
First of all, you don't get to deem yourself an ally. So let's say that.
And, you know, I think good thoughts and, you know, I mean, they're like, I don't want this white supremacy thing.
Right.
But you can't help but participate in it. I mean, I think about when, you know, when we get into arguments on Twitter and people are like,
I'm poor in West Virginia. I don't have white privilege. What is white supremacy? And like, well, just because, you know, you don't have gas in your car doesn't mean you don't have a car.
Exactly.
But also, you're poor because of white supremacy.
Right. Mm. Let's not forget
that. So be clear.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that, you know, if you can equip a group of people to vote against their own interests or act against their own interests because they want to maintain this little weird foothold in the hierarchy, because they aspire to whiteness or because they believe that whiteness is their main value, then they're suffering from white supremacy too. Now, I'm not interested in locking hands with these people and trying to convince them. You know, that's not our bag. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it's really, really important to understand, you know, the class underpinnings of white supremacy and how this system came to be. I mean, this idea even of, you know, making this distinction between, you know, enslaved Africans and what they call that again?
I don't know.
that was such a good point.
It keeps coming up.
No, but indentured servitude. I mean, so, you know, if you create these systems where one group of people is higher on the hierarchy than the other, and that's the one thing that they cling to, then they're going to be really busy doing things that work against their own interests.
So one thing that we always like to say when folks, oh, I'm, you know, I have this whatever thing. We like to talk about the hierarchy that props up white supremacy. So at the top of that hierarchy is a white, wealthy, cisgender, straight, Christian, able-bodied man. Mm-hmm, is that all the things?
Yes, mm-hmm. It's all the things.
Yes, all the things. The person who has all those things gets to sit at the top of the hierarchy, and all the rest of us get slotted in somewhere beneath him based on our, you know, our gender expression, our, you know, whether or not we are able in our bodies.
Degrees of other from him.
Exactly. And so when you look at it as a hierarchy, we hope if you're actually genuine and you're wanting to understand how this all works, you can understand that if you are a white woman who has all of those things except for you don't identify as a man, then you get to enjoy the privilege that comes with being in that number two spot, right? Mm-hmm, so while you can say, oh, well, I'm not a man and misogyny is a thing, sure. Two things can be true.
Yes.
But you still enjoy a privilege that everybody else who gets slotted down below you doesn't get. And when, you know, when they try to say, oh, well, I don't enjoy this, what I like to remind them is you climb that ladder, right? So often to climb means that you're stepping on something. Mm. You're stepping on somebody in your aspiration to this top spot. Mm. And when you look at it that way, hopefully, if you want to, you can understand the place that you occupy and what that privilege affords you. And if you want to be an ally, you can think about the ways that you can help out those folks who are slotted beneath you and use your privilege to their service.
Can we use violence to fight against white supremacy?
I mean, we can.
We have.
Yes.
Yes, we have. Historically,
we have. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we ever consciously said we're not going to talk about violence in this book.
Didn't. Right.
But I know, you know, for me being raised by Black nationalists in Philadelphia, the specter of violence was always present, not in our household, but just this discussion around armed struggle, you know, this discussion around, you know, liberating people from imprisonment and that sort of thing. But honestly, that's not something I would ever put in a book, number one. It seems sort of strange to advocate for violence in a book like this one. But number two, right now, our most current contemporary forms of resisting white supremacy are not violent. So if we did this book in, you know, 1972,
it would be a different conversation.
Of
course.
Yeah.
So, okay, so what are the core ways that you just referenced of fighting against white supremacy?
I mean, it's a tough question, right? So we have like 71 different contributors in the book, and each of them has their own individual way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the genesis of the whole idea was that, you know, we are not a monolith. So the idea came from, you know, Walt Whitman has that poem, Song of Myself. And then he says, you know, do I contradict myself? Okay, fine. I'm not, you know, I contain multitudes. And I used to like use that idea to talk about how I could dance on tables on Saturday and go to church on Sunday. And then I extended it to talk about Black people and how we are not a monolith. We all are different. We love different things. Some of us don't eat chicken. Even though I don't eat chicken or watermelon. It's fine.
Me neither.
Whatever. But just as there are millions of us who are dealing with the ravages of white supremacy, there are millions of ways for us to do. We all have to come to our own ways. I mean, the chapters are a really good, you know, way of kind of putting those ways into buckets, but it's impossible to think about it in one way. But so we have, you know, people who talk about how we love ourselves whole and how loving on the people who we are closest to and on ourselves as a race is a way of resisting. We have the humor chapter where we talk about, you know, sarcasm and man, the satire in that chapter is fucking amazing. You know, we have the I Make Money Moves chapter, which looks at the ways that that happens. We have the Freedom Dreaming chapter, which looks at the way that we look toward the future. We have a chapter on religion and spirituality and how that plays. And so while we can bucket it, we can't contain it.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I remember going to Bates and giving a talk there, and one of the kids was asking me, like, you know, basically, you know, we get into arguments with these little Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson types, and like, you know, what do we do? What do we say when we get in these arguments? Because they have the feeling and the passion, but they may not have all the statistics on whatever particular issue that they're going into, and the other kid doesn't either, but he's lying, he's making it up, he's Fox Newsing it,
yeah,
and...
Yeah.
you know, and you can see, and we've been there. Well, maybe you, not you guys, if you went to Howard, but like I remember going to a white school and you get in those arguments and you don't crush the other person because mm-hmm. usually in an argument you don't win. There's not usually a clear winner. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you have let down the race because you didn't convince or dominate this discussion with this person. And I told the girl, you don't have to engage
discussion.
Exactly.
That's literally what I was going to say. We don't engage.
You're not here to educate them.
Google is a thing. Google exists.
And it was like this weight lifting off of her. I remember all the advisors were behind her like, yes, yes, yes. And she was like, what? Like, I don't have to have the discussion at all? Nope. Like, because you're – and so many of us feel like we're here to as an adjunct for their experience. But if you are centering your experience and that conversation is not helpful to you getting your job done, getting your education, you're going to be upset and emotional the rest of the day, then just don't have it. And it's like – and that became part of my college presentation every time I went, because it's like, it's so liberating, and they didn't even think of that, and I didn't think of that when I was in college. And so this is partly what you guys are driving
that
toward.
That is this book in a nutshell.
I mean, in a nutshell. we don't address black so-called conservatives in the book.
Right.
We're not reaching across the aisle, you know, these sort of euphemisms, because, you know, ultimately, this is a form of aggression. Yes. And it's a form of violence. So, again, walking up to somebody, blindsiding them, peppering them with half-truths or peppering them with this idea that they should be subjugated because they're not white, and then saying, what do you say to that? Like, what kind of weird ritual is that? Like, just kind of like, we're just not going to do it.
Right. I'm not going to center you at any turn. That's not what I do. It's not what I care about. And so we don't.
And black conservatives are part of the apparatus of white supremacy.
Yeah, because they, as we were talking about the hierarchy, they're stepping on the rest of our heads, reaching for that top spot, aspiring to whiteness, ultimately.
And the like the poor people you referenced before who are voting against their own interest, right? I mean, like, I look at Candace Owens, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, it's not even half-truths. It's not non-truths.
She's a charlatan, though.
Yes.
I think she's a charlatan. I don't actually think that at her core she believes a good three quarters of what she's saying. Mm-hmm. I think that she just wants to be famous. I think she wants attention. Mm-hmm. And I think she definitely goes for talking points that end up being dramatic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, again, the things that she says are blatantly false. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they literally don't make historical sense. Right. So even if you are a white supremacist, you probably regard history a lot more than somebody like her. Mm. And so, you know, just because she has a black face and she shows up and then folks say, you know, well, we had her in the room, so it wasn't racist. It's just like, come on, we know that game. Just knock it off.
Right. So I love the therapist who talks about race-based traumatic stress injury.
Yeah, Quinji.
Right? Quinji, yeah.
What is that?
So that's what we were talking about earlier about how we have the symptoms of PTSD and how, you know, we can physically in our body manifest the violence that comes with being in spaces that are violent to us, are not just not made for us, but that they're actually hostile to us, whether it's that somebody is reaching in your head or, you know, asking you, oh, wait, did you cut your hair? You know, that whole thing that they like to do to us. It is how you feel. It manifests in ways like high blood pressure and anxiety and
racism has a physical effect on the body.
It does.
It is well documented.
Shorter because of it.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
I have a story to share that happened last night.
Oh, wow.
We were coming from Manhattanville College. They have an event every year called Ella Baker Day. Mm-hmm. And it was a really great event. And I was, you know, on my way home in the car. And I was, like, literally smiling to myself. And then a white man ran up next to the driver, asked him for money. The driver was like, no. And he was like, fucking niggers. And I was like...
Right. You went,
right. I mean, wait, so...
What?
So,
he went from 0 to 100.
Right. And so it was just kind of like, I was just going along my black ass day, enjoying myself. You know, I'd had a button with Ella Baker on it given to me. I was feeling good. And then out of nowhere, like, here comes this assault. And so I carried that around for a good 3 hours into my night. So even though I knew that this man was probably mentally disturbed and everything, but it's still traumatic and it still made me fear. it still made me say, can you make sure all the doors are locked? Because I don't know what this person is going to do. And so, you know, I think the combination of microaggressions and the systemic piece and then this like sudden aggressiveness and this sudden verbal violence is you know, it makes your blood pressure spike.
It does. It comes with an increased heartbeat.
And yeah, the overflowing of cortisol. I mean, that's how you end up with heart disease.
How do you feel about that incident now? Like right now, like what? I assume we were like 12 hours away from that. Like,
I mean, honestly, when I say those words, I feel tension. Like I feel tension in my stomach from that.
Wow.
Because, you know, I know what that is connected to. And especially now in this climate, I mean, you know, three black churches allegedly burned by a deputy sheriff's son. You know, the burning of the Highlander Center, you know, in Tennessee and, you know, a racist white supremacist mark found on the site. Like this violence is real.
Yeah.
I feel like it's escalating.
Yep.
And I feel like, you know, there's a leader in place who not only welcomes it, but, you know, drives it and folks see themselves in that. And so I'm not going to say that this man who was panhandling, you know, is part of some great, you know, white supremacist plot.
No.
But they feel emboldened, right?
Well, like, he was emboldened. And also, I felt scared. And I'm just like, why do I have to feel scared?
Absolutely. Yeah. You shouldn't have to feel scared.
Just trying to get home.
Yeah, no, not at all. There's so many things that I like underlined and starred as I was going through the book. White privilege is a hell of a white privilege is a hell of a drug. Like, wow. Yeah, but it's true. It's true.
It's addictive.
And it's meant to really prop up poor white people to make them think you have status so that they will participate in the whole game. Mm-hmm. Because if they were just on the bottom level with us, then they would join with us in trying to overthrow the system, right? Yeah. I mean, this is the beginning of racism in America, giving poor white people something to hold on to. So, like, you're above somebody, so then you'll participate in the system.
That's right.
But also, I mean, I think there have been times when poor white people have tried to band together with, you know, subjugated black people. And those movements are actually crushed. I mean, history shows us that.
You're talking about like the Poor People's Campaign, like
no,
Dr.
I'm
King
thinking or... more of I'm thinking more of coal miners and the Pinkerton agents.
Okay.
And so this idea that number one, some of the coal mining outfits were actually they weren't segregated. There were black folks, there were white folks. I mean, I'm not saying it was all kumbaya, but what I'm saying is they all worked in the same position, and they all realized, you know, the very clear health risks and the fact that they were sharecroppers of mining. So you have a company, Pinkerton, that sends agents out to enforce the company's will. And so, you know, white folks got killed in that. Poor white folks got killed in that. So it's not just that, you know, poor white people, I mean, I think many, many don't know. But the point is when people wake up, when they do find out, they also find out what the violence of the state is going to be.
Mm. I don't believe you talk about segregation as a potential solution.
No. We do not.
Is it? Do you think about that? Should we be buying up some land in Montana? We all move there? Or we all move to St. Croix? Or Jamaica?
Come on, Montana.
I mean, we do talk about the importance of finding and creating spaces that are for us. I think that's as far as we go.
Does it mean like creating, like, you know, our own, I don't know, company where it's, you know, mostly us and we can not have to code switch because, you know, most of the company.
And we do have people who talk about that and how the way that they fight is that they create workspaces for black people and then they put money, they use that money to, you know, employ black people and put money into our own communities and things like that. You know, like for me, it meant my daughter was in a school that was heavily white. Mm-hmm. I put her in it because it was a Montessori school, and we were moving from one area to another, and I wanted her to have a continuation of the way that she had begun learning. And I got there and very quickly realized that even though she had teachers who were not white, that these folks were aspiring to whiteness and were propping that shit up, mm-hmm. and making my child a martyr for them. Mm-hmm. And so it meant really evaluating what value did I think was involved in her being in this white space and realizing that there was none, and pulling her the fuck out of there and putting her in a blacker space where she's able to be fed in that way. She's in the second grade now. This happened last year.
So she's at a black public school.
She's at a public school that is very racially diverse, majority black, and both of her teachers are black now. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. she's thriving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it really meant me interrogating what the value was of her being in that space, and realizing that her being in a space where she could see herself affirmed every day was much more valuable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are segregationist moments that we can create in our lives, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps in your home, perhaps in your church, perhaps in your community, maybe in your professional life. But for the most part, you're going to have to learn to live with them. And another line that I underlined and starred, white people aren't going away. We have to find a way to exist with them.
Yeah.
And it's such a great sentence. And I mean, I would love to not have to code switch, but like, you know, at least in this generation,
yeah.
We're going to have to find a way, right?
I mean, yeah, like, we haven't reached that particular freedom dream.
I mean, we can fight white supremacy and get along with them.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Well, I mean,
I know it's hard.
Yeah, that's kind of a doozy. I mean, I think that if you understand that it is unnatural that you should be subjugated mm-hmm. because you're not white,
mm-hmm.
when you have that fundamental understanding and you carry yourself in that way, you communicate that, there's something very calming about it. Like, mm-hmm. suddenly, the assaults and the gaslighting and the touching and the invasion of space don't have the same impact. And it's also, as Kenry says, it's a lack of, I don't need to center white supremacy or white folks for me to resist white supremacy.
Mm.
You know, I resist white supremacy by living on my own terms.
Being your black
at this
ass
point,
self.
Being my black ass self. And, you know, I think code switching, again, is a really important tool. But when you're code switching in your actual mind, like when you're coming mm-hmm. out of your body to try to put yourself in that person's mm-hmm. shoes and then try to justify why you should be in the same space, that is a really just unnatural and bizarre action if you think about it free of, you know, the underpinnings of this society.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, just I have white people in my family, you know, and they come to Kwanzaa. They, you know, they can come. It's cool. Like, nobody's like, you know, get out of here. I'll punch you in the face. But it's also about claiming your space.
That's right.
And claiming your privacy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and understanding that, you know, you could call it segregation, or you could call it being collective. You could call it being selective.
I did a big story a couple years ago on Black Lives Matter and spent like a year sort of for Rolling Stone, spent like a year sort of talking to folks. And the biggest takeaway that I found that media does not discuss around them is the massive importance of self-care, right? Media focuses on BLM, activist, aggressive, you know, highway closing, you know, protesting. But about 50% of their energy is around self-care.
Mm-hmm.
And that is resistance to white supremacy, which is what you're referencing there, like making sure that I am okay. And mm-hmm. like maybe going into a park and claiming a space, this little area is just for black people, you know, or reading something or just doing something that makes you feel safe and centered and comfortable, because you need that, like, exhale, right? Yes. That's part of this, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, to bring it back to Beyonce, because it always comes back to Beyonce.
Amen.
I mean, if you think about Homecoming, I mean, that to me was a resistance against white supremacy because she created this gigantic platform for all of these black dancers, these young black dancers, singers, musicians. And, you know, I really do believe that there was a safe space element to it, yeah. you know, and you had folks saying, I didn't want to go home after this. And mm-hmm. so it's not that it was Shangri-La, and it's not that it regarded white people in any particular way. No. It just allowed people to bathe in our culture and be a part of our culture and show what we're proud of and what we can do.
And she was so intentional about That's it. Right. I think about Coachella as like super white boy yeah, space. Definitely.
And she was like, instead of breaking out my flower crown, I brought my blackness. Yes, like, yes. You don't have to conform to that space.
Yes.
That's what they, you know, the assimilation, that's what it is about, right? Is us coming into that culture and leaving our own things behind, which again is white supremacy because we're saying that that culture is more important and it is supreme to ours. And she was like, fuck that.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
Black.
Yes. But also leave our culture behind and then other folks pick it up and benefit from it. You know what I mean? Like the aping of our culture, the extraction of our culture. You know what Greg Tate says, everything but the burden. Mm. So why should we leave our culture behind? Why shouldn't we stake our claim? Because you're going to try to steal it and then we're going to have to come up with something else.
As Paul Mooney says, everybody want to be a nigga, but nobody want to be a nigga.
I love that quote. I always love him for that quote. God, when you talk about Dolezaling from Rachel Dolezal, I love you for that. I love you for that. God, what's just to play, you know, devil's advocate? If a white person wants to be down and want to be one of us, what's the problem? Why not let them in?
Listen, if they want to walk around with a knot in their stomach all day because they're worried that somebody's going to call the police because their child is selling lemonade.
Exactly.
Okay, but they're not, they don't have to worry about that. Mm. I mean, I was thinking about this article I read yesterday about how people in the surrounding area at Howard, you know, newer white folks, they are walking their dogs on Howard's campus.
And having picnics
on Howard's campus.
So disrespectful.
And then posting comments like, I was met with hostility on Howard's campus. And I'm thinking to myself, not only did you invade a safe space, a space that's supposed to be safe, but you actually like created a danger in that if you decided to call the police because you felt threatened, or if you decided that somebody was shifty or suspicious or whatever it was, then that can end up because there can be a really violent or deadly outcome to that. Mm-hmm. And so somebody who is white, for our kids, and so somebody who's white and presents as white, they can claim as much as they want that, you know, I feel it in my heart. But, you know, I can't feel in my heart that I'm white.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Nobody's going to be like, oh, yeah, she said she was white, so she's white. Like, that's not how it works.
Mm. No, it sure doesn't work like that. Golly. Ta-Nehisi Coates is in the book because he's an old friend of yours, Akiba.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about, you knew him when he was a poet. Back at,
oh my God.
Back at Howard.
Oh my God.
Taking it back.
No. He's going to kill me. No, Ta-Nehisi has always been brilliant. He's always been, you know, a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
He was a great poet. I think now sometimes he discounts his poetry as derivative of hip hop or whatever, but he was quite a good poet. But I mean, the thing that I appreciate about Ta-Nehisi throughout all of these years is that he does the hard thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, and he's not worried about being curmudgeonly in a way. Mm. You know, if people try to say, you know, try to reduce what he's saying, he holds his ground. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you don't have to agree with him, but he does sort of bear down on what he believes. And he's always been like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love this line. My weapon is radical self-acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of kind of sums up a lot of what you guys have been talking about. Yeah. That if you can center yourself in your mind, that in and of itself is resistance.
That's right. Because mm-hmm. everything wants to tell us that we shouldn't, right? Like white supremacy is greedy. Mm-hmm. It's a liar.
Mm-hmm.
It's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's jealous as hell.
Mm-hmm.
It wants all your time, and it wants you to be focused on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you don't get to focus on yourself. You don't get to freedom dream because you're so busy being having to react to the violence that's coming at you every day.
Mm-hmm. I think about it a lot in terms, like, I see it a lot in culture, right? When a certain piece of culture comes out that is difficult for Black people, and for some people, the response is, well, what happens when white people see this? You know, I think for a lot about Precious, right?
Mm.
Fantastic movie. I loved it.
I beg to disagree.
That's fair. But like, I loved it. I watched it. I loved it because I liked it. Mm. And I remember coming out and some black people saying, well, what are white people going to say when they see, you know, this Black woman with a bucket of chicken running down that she stole running down the street? I'm like, you know, I did not watch the movie with white glasses. That's thinking right. about what will white people say when they see these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that a lot, like them saying, people saying, you know, what about and that is white supremacy sort of colonizing
That's
your
right.
mind.
As Yaba Blay says in the book, we don't even need white people for white supremacy anymore.
Right, right,
but I
right.
do, but, you know, now I'm going to play devil's advocate, I guess.
Again, the devil don't need an
okay,
advocate.
Okay, fine, I'm playing somebody's advocate in here. This idea of the white gaze
yes.
is actually, though, a reaction to violence.
Right.
Right. So it's not about what white people think. It's about what they do with their thoughts. So if, you know, it was illegal for you to look somebody in the eye and they could push you off of a sidewalk, you know, if you could be gang raped and then people say, well, that didn't actually happen. You know,
mm-hmm.
What went through their mind and how they regarded you, it seems as if that would be part of what you want to vanquish. So I'm not saying that deferring to the white gaze works. I'm just saying it doesn't come from a place totally where we're so insecure and we think white people are so great. We have a sense of history. We know what happens
when
there's a perception. There's a fear, and it's a justifiable one.
Absolutely a justifiable fear. I want us to get to a modern place where we can consume at least art and culture mm-hmm. without the white gaze being the filter. And that fear is justifiable, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I want us to just, can we go to the movies and be free and like enjoy the movie without worrying about what white people are going to say?
Yeah, I mean, Jamila Lemieux writes about that in her, it's sort of a speculative fiction piece. Mm-hmm. And so it starts from the future and the narrator is telling folks parts of what happened to get free, mm-hmm. but won't tell the whole story. Mm. But one of the tools or one of the things that, you know, black folks had surpassed in her future was don't embarrass me in front of these white folks. Yeah. Mm. And she actually made an acronym. I don't want to mess it up. But, you know, she made an acronym around this. Mm-hmm. You know, the other day I was talking to my mother and my mother keeps selectively reading parts. And so she's like, don't embarrass me in front of those white folks. She was like, I felt that so much. And I was just like, yeah, because, you know, that is built into our culture. You know, mm-hmm. it is this idea of, you know, it's respectability politics 101. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you, you know, in terms of consuming culture and art. I just want to make sure, I don't want us to be pie in the sky, though, mm-hmm. about it.
What do you mean?
I want us to be pie in the sky, but with an understanding of how we got to this point, right? What the historical underpinning is. But I also want us to say, fuck that history and really, for real, leave all of that behind and think about what we want ultimately, which is to live without the violence of the white gaze.
Mm, the violence of the white gaze. Wow. That's why I loved Django Unchained, because I felt like the subtext of the movie was the throwing off of the white gaze, right? That when he throws off the blanket in the beginning, he has removed it and he moves through the film with this body language that it's a constant running joke. Like he rides into town on a horse looking beautiful, body language, and everyone's shocked because they're not used to seeing that, right? And even at the end, you know, when they open the prison door, the other ones don't leave because they have not been freed in their minds, whereas he's figuring out how can I trick you and shoot you and kill you and get out of here, because he's so free and he's like, I should not be a slave, where they're still stuck in that older mindset of like, this is who we are.
Well, and also stuck by that same fear that Akiva was mentioning, right? Like, mm-hmm. if I even looked like I was looking at the door before, I would have got whipped. Mm-hmm. Is this okay?
Mm-hmm. Shade as resistance.
Yes.
I love that. Yes. Tell me about that.
That is, that's part of a sense of self, you know, it's part of a light touch. It's part of, you know, showing who you are. Again, I mean, there's a cleverness, I think. There's almost like a tricksterism to shade, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are existing, again, in a room and you are not necessarily announcing it. But your air lets people know that you're firmly within your space and you're on your 2 feet and that they shouldn't fuck with you. And so I think shade is, you know, and a lot of people sort of play at shade, like they make it in a comedy. But some of the best resistance I've ever seen is in shade. So if you say, what was that? We were at a book event and somebody mentioned that a presidential candidate had been brought to, you know, his store, and I won't name the person. And we were like, oh, how was it? And he was like, That's all he said.
Yeah, and everybody knew.
And everybody knew. And then he said, I said they visited. I didn't say I brought her.
Mm-hmm.
Or him. Him or her.
Her.
Yeah.
Them.
That person.
A person.
What are you talking about, Akiva?
Nothing.
What you talking about, Akiva?
I'm talking about shade as resistance.
You talking about Kamala?
I'm not talking about anybody.
Where in this is prison abolition, police abolition, or at least significant reform? I feel like we're not really going to begin the real road to freedom without significant wealth acquisition and the end of the war on drugs, mm-hmm. right? Which is damaging and destroying so many black and brown lives. Mm-hmm. Where's that in all this?
I mean, I definitely think that it's essential in that those systems, number one, aside from subjugating people, They also suck resources from other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the New York Times Magazine profile of Ruth Gilmore, I thought was so great mm-hmm. because she talks, you know, about number one, this idea of incarceration is keeping people safe rather than a generator of jobs is a lie. Exactly. You know, this idea even of land possession and how, you know, because, you know, rural farmers or, you know, folks have been dispossessed because of the global economy, et cetera, et cetera. And so they need a new growth mechanism, and it's a prison. And so, you know, if you focus once again and you think that, you know, incarcerating people and over policing and all these things make you safer. Number one, they don't. Mm-mm. And then number two, I mean, of course, they're a huge, huge draw. And they're traumatic. I mean, again, living in the specter of police violence and of being locked up. I mean, I'm 44 years old. I'll go to a store. If I pick up a small item, mm-hmm. I still am like walking around with the item up mm-hmm. in the air. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know. Like, somebody could blindside me. I don't know what somebody's going to do. And right. then I'm ended up pinned on the floor.
Right.
And so, you know, that's part of, I think it's like it's a terroristic form. You know, it's psychological warfare on top of physical warfare.
What do you want folks who are listening to this, who read this, what do you want them to do in terms of, yes, you're already combating white supremacy in your own way in your life, but what more do you want them to do if they haven't currently been being really intentional about it? What like a sort of like a takeaway of like how you can be part of intentionally combating white supremacy?
I mean, I think we spoke to it a bit. I mean, we want them to take that breath and to do that freedom dreaming and figure out what it is that they really want us to work toward, because if you can't envision it, you can't get there. We want them to really figure out what their specific intentional way is. So, you know, while yes, we talk about that getting up in the morning is a thing, right? It is an act of resistance. You know, does it look like taking on a leadership role in a PTA in your kids' school system so mm-hmm. that you can make sure that the boundaries that are drawn do not leave out kids of color because they're worried about it bringing down their test scores? Mm-hmm. Does it look like you, you know, working with the hiring department at your job to make sure that you're not just doing diversity talk, but that you're actually bringing in people and empowering them and paying them what they deserve and supporting them with an entire system that allows them to be able to do their work. Mm-hmm. Looking at very specific things that you can do right where you are, right? Because that's what's really important to us. And, you know, as Akiba was saying, we did this Ella Baker lecture last night. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of her big things was meeting people where they are. Figuring out what you can do in the space that you stand in. And I think that's a really key thing that we want readers to do, is to figure out concrete things that they can do where they are that will help us to push back this system. Because what it ultimately comes down to is us fighting for our liberation, our humanity, and our dignity. And what can you do to do that?
Thanks to Akiba and Kenria for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Torrey Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. I'm on Twitter at Torrey and on Instagram at Torrey Show. Please leave a review. It helps. Going again. Thanks to Akiba and Kenria for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Torrey Show gives you fuel to power your dreams, because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. I'm on Twitter at Torrey and on Instagram at Torrey Show. Please leave a review. It really helps. And tell your friends about the show. Torrey Show is written by me, Torrey, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Brandon Tago. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. And we are distributed by DCP Entertainment, which means we will be back Wednesday with another amazing guest, because the man can't shut us down.